listeners, and welcome back to This Week in Black History, Society, and Culture, a podcast program of Monmouth University's Black and African Diaspora Forum. I am Dr. Nicole Pulliam, your host. Today on This Week in Black History, Society, and Culture, we have Dr. Vernon Smith and Mr. Will Nicholson, who will vibe with me on the topic of white supremacy and the imposter syndrome fallacy. So thank you both for joining me on today's episode. This is one of my favorite things to talk about, and I'm excited because I'm talking about this with two of my favorite people. So before we get into it, how about the two of you introduce yourselves, talk about your role at the university, and anything else you want to share with our listeners today?
Well, thank you, Dr. Pulliam. Or should I call you Nicole for this option today?
So Nicole is fine.
Nicole is fine. Well, thank you, Nicole, for inviting me to be a part of this exciting and truly important topic today. I am Dr. Smith, and I'm the program director over at Monmouth University, and I'm an original from the Bahamas, so I have a lot of international experience as well as being here in America. I've studied here. I went to high school here. Certainly felt this whole concept of an imposter syndrome or an imposter phenomenon at all levels, even internationally. So I'm excited to be here today. And I'm looking forward to our conversation.
And what department? I don't know if I missed that. What department are you with? I know it, but just so our listeners know it.
Yeah, Program Director for Educational Counseling and Leadership, but in particular, the Educational Counseling Program.
Okay. And how many years you've been at the university?
I've been here for 4 years now, believe it or not, 4 years at the institution.
My name is Will Nicholson. First of all, let me just thank you for the invite for the podcast. It's my first podcast, I think, officially, so I'm excited. But I'm currently a graduate student studying student affairs and counseling. So obviously, you guys know me. We've had discussions. It's a pleasure always. Right now, I'm interning with the Office of Fraternity and Sorority Life. I'm also the graduate assistant with the Educational Opportunity Fund program at Monmouth. I'm also your graduate assistant, research assistant, and I'm a president of, or the president of, the Educational Council and Student Association. And I'm also a brother of Iota Phi Theta Fraternity Incorporated. So shout out to my brothers.
Okay. Thank you. And Will, just so our listeners have some context, I know many of our listeners know you. How do you identify in terms of your race or anything else that you feel is important in terms of the way we approach this topic?
I identify as an African-American male, and that's about it.
Okay. Thank you. So for those of you who do not know me and for our listeners, I'm Nicole Pulliam. I'm an associate professor in the Department of Educational Counseling and Leadership, former program director. I've been at the university for almost 7 years now. I identify primarily as Latina. In terms of race, I identify as biracial, both Black and white. And I view this topic as a woman of color because that's the way I walk through the world and that's the way I am perceived. So the way that we'll all approach this topic is really framed from each one of our unique perspectives, right? So when we get into the topic, we will each talk about it both from a gender perspective, from a racial perspective, ethnicity, you know, within the context of the United States and beyond. So we wanted to sort of give our listeners a really in-depth, but a breadth of knowledge related to this topic. So before we get into it, I want to make sure that our listeners are clear on exactly what we're talking about. Many of you might have already heard the term imposter syndrome. The term imposter phenomenon often comes up. I would say it's less known, but it is well known, or more known, I would say, in the literature, particularly in the psychology literature. And this particular concept has framed a current research study that Dr. Smith, myself, and Mr. Nicholson are working on currently. And what we're doing is we're looking at the impacts of the imposter phenomenon on the mental health of Black and Latinx identified first gen college students at Monmouth University. And this research study was funded by the American College Counseling Association. So we'll talk a little bit about that. What I want to do again is frame it. So when we talk about the imposter phenomenon, the definition, and this was termed originally by Dr. Pauline Clance, she's a psychologist, and the definition of that is a psychological pattern based on intense feelings of fraudulence despite success and high achievement. So Dr. Clance's original research, which was from the early 80s, looked specifically at the experiences of women, high-achieving women in the workplace. I want to add high-achieving white women in the workplace, right? So that's where her research started. And then there's been a lot of research. Well, I won't say a lot, a moderate level of research that has come out after that, that started to look at how this played out, particularly for people of color, particularly for students of color. So that's sort of where we fit into this. So that's the imposter phenomenon. This idea of an imposter syndrome is sort of rooted in the imposter phenomenon literature, but the ideas behind it are problematic, particularly because the imposter phenomenon looks at feelings of fraudulence, feelings of not belonging despite high achieving or high, you know, levels of success. And it does frame it from the perspective of, well, what's going on in our environment? You know, what are the sort of systems at play? But again, the original research especially focused on white women. So we're missing the male perspective, and we're especially missing, you know, the other identities or Black and brown people in that literature. Imposter syndrome places or locates the issue within the person, right? So Dr. Smith, future Dr. Nicholson, when I say the term syndrome, what comes to your mind? Because the term syndrome, when it comes to something like this, is problematic in and of itself. So like when I say syndrome, what comes to mind for you?
So when I think of syndrome, right, and I'm thinking about it from a psychological perspective, we're always thinking about it resides within an individual. It's your issue, it's your problem, and something that you could work on and fix. And so as I think about it, it's almost like psychologically some kind of struggle that you're facing, right, from a mental perspective. So when I'm thinking about syndromes, that's the way I'm thinking about it. And so something internally that I could work on, and I have to fix it because it's my stuff, right?
Absolutely.
When I think about the term syndrome, it automatically makes me think about the term trauma, having a traumatic experience, what that looks like for people. And when people look at other people's trauma, they think about, you know, like Dr. Smith said, it's your issue. You know, nothing around you can fix that. Nobody can help you with that. It comes from within. And to me, it can be problematic, but it can also be a motivator for whoever is given that label. So, you know, and we'll dive deeper into it, but yeah. That's what I think of.
Thank you. I want to read two particular things. The first thing that I want to mention, and we'll cite this in the show notes, there was an article that was put out, and it was actually recently edited. Dr. Jen M. Jackson. She is a Black feminist scholar, and she's the co-founder and editor-in-chief of Water Cooler Convos. So she put out an article, and it was titled, "It's Not Imposter Syndrome When You're Black and a Woman." So I want to read a couple things from there because I think she said it beautifully, and it really gives life to the way that we're going to approach this topic. And here's what she says. And I'm leading into another quote here, but here's what she says. She says, "There is a contextual component necessary to this logic that is missing. Black people, especially women, are socialized to believe that they are not allowed to enter these spaces." And I'm going to add here what she's talking about. And the way that we're approaching this is always when we are primarily comparing ourselves to our white peers, number one, and number two, when people of color especially are in predominantly white spaces. So I don't want to lose that focus, because when we approach this conversation, that's really what it's about. Because most of the time, when I have conversations with my peers, Black or Brown identified, what we're talking about has nothing to do with, or we don't necessarily experience it when we're amongst others who look like us, right? What we're talking about is when we are amongst others, when we are in the minority numerically, right? So that's what she's talking about. So she goes on to say, especially women are socialized to believe that they are not allowed to enter these spaces, not only because of the assumptions of inadequacy about their race, but also because of the social norms about the role of women in society. This phenomenon, and she's talking about Dr. Clance's original research, therefore, is not just the embodiment of imposter syndrome when Black women are involved. Instead, it is the byproduct of internalized white supremacy and, in a parallel way, patriarchy, right? So when we're talking about Black women in particular, I'll go on later to share the rest of that excerpt. But I want to dive deeper into this in terms of, again, your own experiences and then your experiences as, you know, as males of color in predominantly white spaces as well, both at the university and maybe even in your personal lives. So Dr. Smith, do you want to chime in there?
Sure. That struck a chord with me. I'm considering this whole idea of this internalized white supremacy, right? And we know that it's centered around white male supremacy. And so as she was talking about the intersectionalities of identities, I just started to wonder and think about my experiences, even transitioning to the U.S. as a high schooler. I was born and raised in the Bahamas, a predominantly Black country, right? And so I've seen leaders, I've seen at all levels in terms of Black prime ministers and the likes, all the way down. And so the racism piece, I might not have dealt with as my forefathers, right? But I thought about my transition to the U.S. and how that was quite different when I entered high school in the U.S. because I was struggling because I had my friends from, because I went to a Black high school. Private Black high school, and in that arena, they couldn't understand how I could be talking with white people. Like, what in the world are you doing? But I had to explain to them, listen, yeah, I grew up in the Bahamas. Tourism is our number one industry. I was used to working and getting along and being connected to people, white people, but in a different arena, right? In this arena of tourists, as visitors, and not the real until I began and I lived in Alabama. Alabama. So my experiences became a reality when I began to experience the stuff that they were talking about. I had to run with them from the police because of the idea that I listen here. They're either going to beat you or they're going to put some kind of crime on you. And so this whole idea of just struggling with myself and just listening, I started to tell my guys, I'm like, listen, I stop running, man. I'm no criminal. I know what I'm all about, and I don't care, right? And I think that was the behemoth side of me coming out and saying, listen, yeah, I wasn't raised to be like this, or I didn't experience the things that you experienced here. But then it started to show up, right? It followed around in stores, things like that. And you began to really understand that. And then I started to look back. I'm like, hold up now. For years of growing up in the Bahamas, around predominantly Black and indigenous people of color, it's still, there was a place of colonialism, right? There was this place that still existed. And even though I transitioned, I began to think back after understanding the experiences of my high school friends and what I went through in the Bahamas, I was raised differently. But at the same time, there were some similarities. There's some similarities to the fact that also in the Bahamas, there's this sense of internalized white colonialism, right? And when I talk about that, I'm talking about the fact that white is right. And that's the statement we say in the Bahamas, white is right. Because as a professional, I could come and introduce an idea to my institution, but while I'm working, or I go into the bank and I present a business plan of what I want to do, and that will be turned down and rejected on the grounds that, nah, you don't know what he's talking about. A couple months later, be a year later, same institutions, you brought the idea, will now bring a white person in as a consultant to give them the same report. And they would value that. And so I just thinking back even professionally and my understanding of being in the Bahamas after going back and coming back to the U.S., I certainly see that those concepts and this whole idea of, and that begins to work on you, right? Because internally you start to self-doubt within your arena. So you start to self-doubt as a professional, like, am I really good enough? What's going on? But we've been taught this for years, right? And despite me having that experience coming to the U.S. and then going back and also understanding that that stuff still is structurally there. It's systematically within our system, right? And so this idea of white supremacy still centers us. And in the Bahamas, our experiences, you know, when we think about white supremacy, you see the colorism stuff coming out and this internalized racism, because we start to even look at ourselves, and those who are lighter are better. Those who are, you know, little straighter or more lush, curly hair, we would say, look at them to be more beautiful, or even favor is laid upon them, right? Even within the classroom and your experiences. So this whole idea of this imposter phenomenon is real across the world. You know, I grew up in a predominantly black country, but colonialism still exists, and that whole premise of operations still impact the Bahamas today. And so now moving to the U.S., it is even real, right? And like I constantly share with you, Dr. Pulliam, the struggle, right, in terms of even, you know you're a professional, you know you're writing, and you're able to articulate and present, but yet you self-doubt, right? Even to the point when you're sending an email, even in a leadership role, you're concerned that everything is spelled right, the grammar is correct, and you're so afraid that people are going to judge you, even on basically sending an email. And my wife would always tease, she'd say, even in the text now, when you're texting, you need to make sure you're checking to make, because, you know, people are going to say, well, you're supposed to be the doctor, right? So you should know better. And so you're constantly in the back of your head feeling that you're being judged and feeling that, you know, because of what you've experienced throughout life and you know what exists around you, you're constantly battling with that. And so that's my two cents on that one.
Thank you. I you know, again, I think what you bring to the table, you know, there are similarities, but it's unique, right? So we talk about, again, going back to this, you know, when you are in the minority numerically, right? So your experience growing up in a predominantly black country versus now being, well, you know, the demographics are shifting. But when we look at being a faculty member or professional in predominantly white spaces, it's different now, right? So it's having to adjust to that. I'm going to say a little bit more after we hear from Will about this idea of, you know, we're trained to respond in different ways. We are, based on, you know, this white supremacist thinking, we are trained to feel inferior. But I want to open it up to Will, and then I'm going to go back to a couple of those things. So Will, what about your experiences both as a student and a leader? What do you want to share with us?
Well, first and foremost, I think, I have an experience where it kind of goes overshadowed. A lot of people, they don't even think about how this could be a possibility. So, you know, I had to deal with the idea of not feeling like I fit in white society and black society, because I grew up as early as I can remember, I was always that black kid who was in the high honor classes or the gifted and talented classes. And I didn't feel, you know, my white classmates, they didn't really, you could tell they didn't want me there because they wanted it to be a pure environment. And then when I get around my black classmates, they're like, why do you think you're better than us? Or they're like, you know, you should come to our class. We could have more fun. So, and I didn't really feel connected to anybody unless I was playing a sport. So, and I think that's, you know, that's a whole nother topic, but that idea, if you have to play a sport to make it as a black male in this country. But I mean, my experience, like I said, it's been so crazy. All I've known is basically racism. Like that's all I've dealt with coming up through school. And it's affected me so much. It really is a trigger to talk about these things. Just as early as like middle school, you know, I'm in middle school classes and I've had people say craziest things to me. White students ask me what I'm doing here, you know, and mind you, I'm in a class, I'm in a school where it's diverse, but most of the classes, the higher honor classes, they're filled with all white students, and the black students are just usually the athletes, the jocks, stuff like that. And it kind of followed me into high school. I went to three different high schools and, I didn't feel at home at any school until I got to the last one, which was like 99% black. And that was my first time experiencing an all black school for the first time in my entire life. But the first school I was at, it was like a melting pot. And there was a lot of diverse groups, but it was still segregated. So, you know, you can go and you can sit in the lunchroom and there'll be the black table. There'll be a white table. There'll be a Asian table. It was just a whole bunch of labels. And for me, I've always been the type of person where I can fit in anywhere, but I didn't feel at home anywhere. So it was tough to navigate. And, you know, even after that school, going into an all white high school, that was probably the worst experience because I dealt with so much racism and discrimination within 1 year, more than any time in my life. I've had the basketball coach. He was mad because, you know, I felt like I deserved a chance to do something that I love to do. And he thought I was questioning his authority. I've had teachers talk to me about him, say, you know, he's racist, so just deal with it. It'll be okay. You know, I tried to take my SAT at the same school. They called the cops on me and my dad because they wouldn't let me in. I dealt with so much there. I've had people call me the N-word. These things I just try to, you know, kind of forget about. But it's hard because I'm always reminded. So when you think about my undergraduate experiences, you know, I was fearful of being me. I was fearful of being that high achieving student because I didn't want to be judged. I didn't want anybody to look at me like a token, but yet it continued to happen regardless. And it would be times where I'm in class and I know the professor could ask a question. I already know the question. I know what it is. I know the answer. I wrote the notes. I read everything, but I would tell myself, don't answer it. Because if you answer it, your classmates are going to look at him like, oh, here he go. He doesn't deserve to be here. Why does he always have to speak? So I always said, you know what? I'll let them have it. And that's why I ended up changing my major twice, because I never enjoyed what I was doing. And it wasn't until I changed for the second time and I had a white professor who she could tell that I was being hesitant. And she allowed me to just open up and to speak, just to be firm on my ideas and my thoughts. And to this day, I talk to her and I always thank her for allowing me to be me and to see that I was, you know, obviously in a different state mentally. It's so hard to talk about this. I mean, as a graduate student, you know, I'm at a school where it's all white. And it's crazy because even though I'm, you know, I'm 23, I'm a little older, more mature, I understand things differently. I'm still afraid to like speak my mind. I'm still afraid to be who I am because anytime I say something or anytime I do something, I always have to think, maybe I angered this person. Maybe I offended this person. They're going to come get me next week. And even my classmates, like if I'm in class and we're talking about a subject and I hear something that might offend me, I can't necessarily say, you know, I'm offended by this. Let's have a discussion, because they'll look at me like I'm the angry Black student in the class. I've had students, you know, within the last year or so, basically use microaggressions against me. And I've had to, you know, pull them to silence and say, listen, you know, I don't appreciate this. But even doing that is a little fearful because, you know, you don't want it. Long story short, this is definitely a tough topic for me because it's my entire existence. And I've had to get to a point of understanding that I'm not going to be able to escape this existence. So how do I cope with it as best as possible? That's why having that experience as a Black student at a PWI, any chance I get to write a paper on those experiences, to ask other peers, to ask my students about their experiences, I take that opportunity because I want to learn more. I want to figure out how I can get into the student affairs profession and help out those students who have the same exact identity, but are too afraid to share it because they might not have the support that they need. So, like I said, this is definitely a triggering topic, but I think it's something that needs to continue to be discussed because it's not going anywhere. I don't think it's going to get any better. But I think with the right support systems for our students, I think we can help their lives kind of, you know, we can help shape their lives a little bit differently. You know, they don't have to fall under that label. I think we can help them out a lot. So that's my two cents.
And Will, I thank you for that. And thank you to Dr. Smith as well. And Will, you know, I particularly thank you because I fully acknowledge as a counselor educator, and all of us, you know, within the counseling profession, we know that these experiences are real. We know that they are rooted in white supremacist thinking and, you know, rooted in systemic issues, especially, you know, I mean, just looking at educational, settings, particularly in environments that weren't built for us, that weren't built for people of color, that weren't specifically built for Black people, right? You know, higher education in general wasn't necessarily built for us, A, to be able to enter, let alone to be able to thrive in, right? And I'm glad you said what you said, Will, because we know a couple of things, both from our work as practitioners and from what the literature says, is that there are mental health implications that come out of all of this, right? And one of the things that I've learned in terms of my own reflection as a woman of color, and that we especially heard from participants in our research study, who were all EOF students at Monmouth University, by the way, were all high achieving. They were either recent grads or very close to graduating with, you know, really high grade point averages. And the things that we use to measure success at the college level, yet we know that these feelings still exist, right? So when it comes to higher education, I have a big problem with solely basing it on graduation rates, because what that fails to do is give narrative to students' actual experiences, right? So while students might be graduating, they're not thriving. They're barely surviving just to get to graduation. And we heard that come through in each one of those interviews that we ran, just with those 11 participants, shed light on that. Right. And I shared with the two of you that each interview that I did, I had to sit with it for a moment because I think it did trigger some really key pieces in me and my own experiences, but it was heavy. Right. So when we think about these students' experiences, when we reflect on our own experiences, even still, right, as a faculty member of color at a predominantly white institution where I could very easily count on one, maybe close to two hands, the number of faculty at the university who look like me, that comes with some mental health implications that we cannot overlook. So, you know, let's talk about that a little bit, because I know that what I heard from our participants and heck, what I've experienced or sometimes continue to experience, I'm just now able to label it and understand where it's rooted. there is a lot of anxiety. There is a lot of stress. There is a level of depression that comes out of this. What struck me the most in the data, and that really, I think, made me reflect on my own experience, is what I call this sort of hustle hard mentality, right? It's like, let me just continue to grind and hustle hard and move on to this next achievement, because two things. Number one, I have no choice, because I feel like as a person of color in a predominantly white space, I have to work 10, 20, 30 times harder to be viewed as a respectable professional in my field, when all, and I'm going to say it, when all my white counterparts need to do, some of them are fabulous and some of them are barely mediocre. When I send an email, when I hold a conversation with someone, when I dare to raise my hand and speak at a full faculty meeting, I am already internally checking what I'm going to say. And then almost immediately wondering, did I say that the right way? Did I come across as angry, right? All of these things that I have to experience, and perhaps the two of you experience, that perhaps our white counterparts do not, right? So I'm going to throw it out there. I want to make mention of one other reference. Mike Mena, he's out of the Graduate Center at the City University of New York. He produces a YouTube channel titled The Social Life of Language. And he has an episode on YouTube as part of that called What If Imposter Syndrome is a Racist Concept? And this is how he approaches it, right? And the way that he is now shifting the narrative, he's calling it imposter training. And when I first listened to him, I thought, that makes sense, right? Let's shift the narrative. So what he says is, and I'm quoting him, we, as people of color, we're trained to feel inferior. We're trained to feel as if we don't belong, right? So the way that we automatically think about something, it's almost like, I'm going to go back to something that Will mentioned, again, speaking as a counselor, it's almost like a trauma response, right? Because we are so used to feeling inferior and so used to being excluded that it just becomes part of our daily lives, right? But that's a trauma response. So we either continue to hustle hard and try to chase success because we feel like we need to in order to be respected, right? What some other people do is, so you either work hard, you work toward perfectionism, or you procrastinate because you cannot move past the ideas in your mind, right? Like there's this whole mental process that happens even before we write an email, right? Even before we open our mouths, if we do, right? So Will, you talked about, I already know the answer. I wrote it down, but I chose to not even say anything. We're already working all of this through in our minds, right? That is a response, a self-protective response to not having to experience that, because we know what those potential implications might be, right? How anxiety provoking is that? How stressful is that, right? What does that do to our own self-concept, right? And I'm like, when I started intentionally surrounding myself with Black and Brown greatness, it wasn't until then that I was like, nah, we are out here doing the damn thing. Despite all of these things going on, we are still doing the damn thing. 10, 20, 30 times better, right? So let's celebrate that, right? So that's the other thing. I think when we approach this topic, it's not necessarily to just wallow and sit in these feelings, because that's not what this is about. And I would say, you know, we want our listeners to know that we don't want sympathy for this. We don't want y'all to feel bad. We want y'all to know what we're experiencing, but we equally want you to know that we're out here doing the damn thing. But I just think that's important. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to make mention of that, but we are trained to respond that way. So I want to throw it out. Let's talk a little bit about the mental health components of it. And again, as counselors ourselves, what we're seeing, what we're experiencing, what are your thoughts about the mental health pieces of that? We'll end this with like talking about, so what do we do about it now? Like how do we cope? How do we continue to acknowledge these things? But let's talk about the mental health pieces first. So whoever wants to take that on first.
Let me, because I got a lot in my brain. I just want to get it out before I lose it. So let me start off by just talking about my experience with mental health. I was never big on just being open about it until I was at the lowest point. I never thought about it because in the Black community, it's like, you know, if you're dealing with something, talk about it with your parents or your brother, your sister. Don't express it. Like, keep it bottled in. So for me, even though I came from a very supportive household, I was still dealing with that in society with my friends. They would tell me the same things like, yo, you're not supposed to cry. You know, so to me, it was just ingrained. But, you know, as an undergraduate, you know, I was working as a resident assistant. And that was my sophomore year. So my first year, I commuted the entire time. So I never really got the actual student experience. I never had the chance to see what college really had to offer because I would go to class and leave. So going into my sophomore year as a resident assistant, I'm in charge of all these students and I'm making sure that their experience is great, but I'm not really getting my own experience. So that really played a part in just my depression, because let's just call it what it is. I was very depressed at that point. I didn't even know what depression really was. I just knew that I didn't feel right. There was a time, and I'll be extremely transparent with this story, because I think people really do need to hear it. So I've always been a very high achieving person. I mean, that's, I always wanted to be at the best. I never wanted anybody to question the type of student that I was. When I became an RA, you know, you have to have a certain GPA to stay in stay in that position. I couldn't get over that hump because I had so much going on. I had my fraternity. I had to deal with 60 students, you know, all being females at that. So, you know, that's a whole bunch of problems with first year female students dealing with sexual assault issues, domestic violence issues, suicide situations. All of those situations kind of fell back on me because as an RA, as a worker, as a professional, you want to be the best possible. And at that time, I was probably one of the best RAs in the building. So a lot of people couldn't deal with that, with those serious issues. So they would just pass it to me. And being the high achieving person, I never said no. I always said, yeah, I'm up for the challenge. So I took on their issues on top of mine. When I couldn't get over that GPA hump, I knew there was going to be a point where they're going to fire me from the job. And let's remember that the job, in terms of college experience, that's all I knew. I didn't know any other college experience because when I became an RA, that's when I started to experience what it was. I knew I was getting fired about a week or two before I got fired. But that entire month, nobody really knew this, but that entire month, every day, I forgot the month, but it was like, from the first day to the 30th, I would be in my room, lights out, pitch black, no music. I had the screen door or the screen to the window. I had it open because I was very like suicidal at that point and always thought if anything, I could just jump out the window because I didn't know how to deal with it. And it wasn't until like the 30th day when another one of my colleagues, also a Black male, he came to the room and he noticed that something, like I wasn't responding, but he knew I was in there. And he came in and, you know, we talked and he just kind of just asked me like, what's going on? That's when I broke down. And that was a special moment because he was going through his own situations, but being Black men, we don't talk about it. And that was a day where we decided to both go to the counseling services because obviously something was going on. So I use that story because, like I said, that was the first time when I really realized I was in a terrible space mentally and I was at the lowest point and I didn't see anybody or know anybody that could help me, any Black males on the campus that were even interested. You know, we had a few faculty members on the campus, but you had the few who they were there to get the paycheck, and then you had the few who they act like they really care for you, but it's like they just trying to play like this role. It's hard to describe. And my mental health, it hasn't recovered since, really. Like it hasn't. I just kind of finished up therapy this past like couple months. I went to therapy for like 2 years. Now I finally feel better. I was in that deep space. I was like maybe 19 going on 20. So you're talking about a range of 19 to 23, 24, just dealing with a whole bunch of stress. So, I mean, when it comes to mental health, a big thing is having people that look like you who can express the same things going on and your willingness to have those conversations. Because if it wasn't for my friend, I don't know where I would be, to be honest. And I want to thank like my mentor, because my mentor, I hope he listens to this, but my mentor, he was the first and only Black male on the campus who cared about who I was. Not just like my existence on the campus, like, okay, you're a Black male here, you're studying this. Like, he wanted to know who I was, how I was raised, how's your faith? He's a man of faith. I'm a person of faith. So he helped me with that. He helped me grow in that sense. And he had a lot of patience in our discussions, our conversations. I was hesitant about asking him to be my mentor because I didn't know how to do that. So I remember I'm sitting and we're sitting in the calf and I'm like, listen, I don't know how to do this, but you know, I definitely need a mentor. And I was a senior at that point. I was heading out. But since then, he's been nothing of a support. So long story short, I think when it comes to mental health and what Black and brown students deal with on campus, a big role is, or a big factor is, the role that Black and brown faculty play. Without that representation, our students will go down a really bad path, because we're in an age of social media where things are mental health is really going down a drain. And it's so important that we really start opening up these conversations and really start to talk about our experiences. So my experience that I dealt with depression and anxiety, because my depression led from that wanting to achieve and feeling like a failure if I don't keep this job, if I don't get my GPA to a certain point. So what are the conversations that we have with our students? And are we willing, as professionals, as counselors, as peers, are we willing to open up and just be honest? And if the tears flow, let them flow. Whatever needs to happen, what are the conversations that we're having to really get over this hump and to cope? So, I mean, I hope that touches somebody and, you know, they're willing to make that step. But it's definitely been a battle for me, but I'm glad that I was able to take that step and seek therapy. So therapy, representation on campuses, and just transparency and support from one another, I think it'll go a long way.
Thank you for that, Will. You could give your mentor a quick shout out if you'd like.
yeah. Shout out to Mr. Walker. I call him Reggie Walker. He's currently the director of EOP at Rider University. That's my guy. I appreciate it. I love him. So shout out.
Yeah. Shout out to Reggie and shout out to EOF as always. We'll make sure that he gets this link and he listens. So, but thank you so much for sharing your experience as well. Dr. Smith.
That's a tough act to follow, Will. Thank you for being so candid and real and the sense of vulnerability, right? And it really shows your level of growth and dealing with the challenges, right? You talk about depression, you're talking about anxiety. And it just brought me back to the whole notion and the whole idea that set this off, right? It's this expectation that's so much greater and higher that we can't afford to fail, right? We feel like we can't afford to fail because there's a lot of pressure on us, right? Internally for ourselves, but also externally, because, you know, the expectation is the Black male is going to be the failure anyway. And so when we think about that, that's like you internalize that and you're just so afraid to fail that you start taking on more. because you wanted to be successful. So listen here, I can't say no because what are they going to think, right? I can't do it, afraid to do it. So you just give in and say, yeah, okay, I'm going to take it on. And then it becomes so much for us, right? And us faculty, as a student, walking the halls and understanding these experiences, we're afraid of how people view us. And they might not be saying it, but it's a sense of how we feel in these spaces and the fear that we don't feel like we belong here. Like, I don't feel accepted. And Will, I really appreciate how you talked about, you know, diversifying the faculty, diversifying leadership on campus, right? And so really creating opportunities for our students to connect, but also Black persons or people of color, and so that we can actually begin to mentor and support each other. And I can truly say for myself, going through, the PhD program, you know, when I walked into that program, my program director was a Black male, a veteran in the field. And the first thing he said to us when we entered the door, he said, no excuses. You guys are great. Otherwise, you wouldn't be here. And so at the end of the day, I don't expect nothing else but all of you to graduate and make a difference in this world. And so just that just changed the whole dynamic, right? In terms of letting us know that, hey, I'm here for you. I believe in you. And I'm here to support you through this process. And he was not my faculty advisor, but guess what? I made him my mentor right away. So, well, I know what you're saying. Being able to connect with that individual, because there's a sense of trust, right? It's real. I always say, and as I'm sharing with people, because of all of this white supremacy stuff and this fear of actually succeeding, right, or people seeing you in that light, you tend to want to just surround yourself with people that you feel are like allies, right? And what's easier than looking for people of color, right? Because that's your comfort. That's what it is, because there's a trust issue here. Because I'm not sure if I can trust a white person, right? And not that they mean anything or they don't, but we got to test that out for a while before we come to a place of acceptance. And you know something? This is a true ally. I can count on them. I know they got my back. But at the end of the day, and then we can feel like we can be vulnerable with them and share some stuff. But guess what? It's still that challenge. And so I would say the institutions, let's be intentional about really diversifying our hiring, right? If we're serious about in predominantly white institutions, at least beginning to create a space that you want to serve and sincerely provide the resources and support for our students of color, all right? And so as a counselor, we have a duty, right? We have a duty even to actually mandate that institutions do better. In light of what happened this summer, it's time we can begin to speak up. Hey, we can feel the imposter phenomenon, but listen, yeah, we got to push through that. At the end of the day, let's pool our resources together. Listen, yeah, find our partners and just march on to just change the narrative, because we have to. We can't afford not to if we're going to create a society that's just and equitable for all of our students and future. I'm a father. My daughter is sophomore in university. And she struggles with some of the same things. And she said, Daddy, I would know the answer, but I don't want to speak up. I don't want to say it, right? I don't want people to see me as, oh, I always know what to say, or I got the answer, or seeing like Will said. And on the other hand, she's like, you know, sometimes you doubt yourself. Like, I wonder if this is correct, you know? So in ourselves, we want to know that we are 100% or 110 or 120, like you said, 130% better, and knowing what we need to know before we are willing to speak out. And so how do we create those safe spaces? I think it's upon faculty. We create those opportunities for our students to just be able to share and be honest. And really, not just in the classroom, right? But like Will said, do you stop and pull me aside before class, in the hallways, to even say anything to me? You know, how do I feel a sense of belonging? When you come and you want to know more about me, you want to talk with me, you want to share with me, you want me to be a part of this world. And sometimes I think there's a block, right? We think we're doing the service, but at the end of the day, we're just leaving our students to struggle by themselves. And so, you know, as in all of us, yeah, we're busy, but we got to take the time to help reach out. Thank you, Will, for sharing.
Thank you. Yeah, thank you, Dr. Smith. Thank you, Will. You know, I think so much of this, again, it's hard to talk through, right? Because I think it plays out in so many aspects of our lives, within school settings, within work settings, within our, you know, where we live, especially if we live in spaces that are predominantly white. You know, as a parent, where do we move? Where do we send our children to school? You know, Will, you talked about your experience as in both types of schools where it was predominantly white and predominantly Black, right? And the challenges that you faced in both settings, right? It's almost like I'm damned if I do, I'm damned if I don't. So what do I do, right? So it is going back to this whole fallacy of imposter syndrome. It's so much more than just this general self-doubt for high-achieving people. One of the things that I wanted to add before we end is that we know from the research that the higher achieving you are, the higher success you obtain, the more degrees, whatever that might look like in your lives, the higher levels of these feelings, right? Because oftentimes when I present this to undergrad or grad students, and I say, well, yeah, I still struggle with this. And they say, but, you know, you have a doctorate and you're a tenured faculty member. And I said, yeah, because you know why? The more you achieve, the more is at stake, the greater the expectation that you both internalize and that people expect from you, right? So now you have a PhD. Now you're tenured, right? Now I really expect you to be this magical unicorn person of color who speaks so well, right? Like all of these things are at play and they increase, they do not decrease, right? It's a matter of us understanding where these issues lie, who we then surround ourselves with. I know for me, I've had some wonderful and still have wonderful mentors who are white women in particular, who have been amazing for me and still are. But it's still different, right? So, you know, Dr. Smith, you talked about this, you know, you got to earn that trust, right? So, but for a person of color, it's an automatic, right? It's an automatic given. That doesn't mean that they're always the best mentors. I just want to throw that out there. But there is this automatic sense of trust solely based on a shared race or ethnicity, solely based on that. Right. And then it's almost like, well, prove to me otherwise. And then if I can't trust you, then I'll adjust my expectations. But I wanted to throw that out there because when we talk about, like Dr. Smith said, as an untenured faculty member, right, feeling the need to say yes to everything, feeling the need to always be viewed as a team player because of what's at stake, you know, when you're a student leader or when faculty or whoever approach you and that pressure to always say yes, knowing that you may not be able to handle not one more thing, we say yes anyway, and we figure it out later, right? So we survive through it. We might thrive at that task, but no one knows what's going on internally for us. And that becomes isolating if we don't find our people to share these experiences with. So this type of platform really opens up that narrative. And I hope that, you know, those listening could relate to many of these pieces. And for those who cannot, who can begin to understand these experiences, Will, I'm so glad you talked about diversifying faculty, because that's one of the major things that are on the table, you know, at Monmouth University and at many universities, right? And the importance of that. So I wanted to circle back to that because I wanted to make sure people heard that. Before we end, I want to just, again, circling back to the role that white supremacy plays, I want to read the second excerpt from the one article that I cited by Dr. Jen Jackson. And she says, by labeling every single moment of self-doubt expressed by, and in this case, women, but I'm going to say Black, Indigenous people of color overall, I'm going to add that piece, as imposter syndrome by labeling it as simply that, flatten the complexities and pervasiveness of white supremacy and for women and patriarchy. Not only that, we situate women, in this case, Black, Indigenous people of color, as just needing to lean in or pull themselves up by the bootstraps, right? This whole idea of meritocracy, that if we just do good, we'll achieve things. And we know that that's a fallacy, that doesn't exist. We can all work hard, but we will not achieve the same things at the same, you know, at the same level or equitably. And when they don't pull themselves up, they're still met with opposition from individual actors and institutions who are invested in their exclusion. I'm going to say that again, who are invested in their exclusion from many public spaces. And I think that's at the heart of it, right? Like we know what this is about, even if it's not intentional. We know that white supremacy is always at play. And how do we work through this all? So that's what it is, right?
Can I chime again, in? It's,
yeah, go ahead, Dr. Smith.
Man, I just got to chime in there because it just brought me back to a place in my graduate program when you talk about this, even non-intentional, right? But white supremacy still exists. And with that comes a whole lot of biases, right? And you know, you were talking about the patriarchy component to this, and we're talking about our identities and how they intersect. You know, it brought me back to a moment where I did all the work for this project, right? Put in my program. But yet the professor, a female, white female, who claims she cared about me, would always smile in my face, but yet she can go behind my back to my colleague or my group partner to ask what was my contribution. And she even tried to give me a lower grade for the group project. The student had to let her know, no. Matter of fact, most of this was his stuff. You know what I mean? But it's just that sense of where people judge you and that pressure. It's real. You know, we have these experiences, right? And so hence we continue to internalize this thing. And we recognize that no matter how much we do, no matter how great we try to be, there are people who are just going to doubt us because of our skin color or even our agenda or whatever else. They're just going to be judging us. And so at the end of the day, that weighs on you. It gets heavy. And you start to self-doubt sometimes. And so that is real. And I thank you for sharing that because that just triggered that. Yeah, she probably wasn't intentional, but those biases just showed up.
I'm sitting here laughing because it's like a nervous laughter, but that happened to me last semester. So, you know, I'm not going to say the class. I'm not, you know, because I just don't want to get that deep. But it happened to me last semester where, you know, I'm still in that mindset where it's like, I know I have to do better than everybody else. Otherwise, there's a chance, you know, I don't want to be seen as average or I don't want people to feel like he didn't do anything. So, you know, we have this group project and I'll try to make this as short as possible, but we have this group project. I already told myself I'm not going to step up. I'm not going to take the lead on it. I'm gonna let the group do, you know, I just go with the flow because I didn't want to take over, but I just felt like I wasn't doing enough. And even when I did kind of step in, I had people saying, oh, you're being negative. You won't conform to the group. You won't. And that bothered me because I'm like, I'm sitting here trying to help. I told myself I wasn't going to say nothing. I'm sitting here trying to help. I'm glad that y'all brought this up because this is literally what I'm dealing with. And I know so many other people, other peers that are dealing with the same things, but they don't have the opportunity to talk about it. People don't care or people just, they're numb to it. So it's just like, I heard it, but it is what it is. And for me, it's just like, back to another point that you said, it doesn't go away. It gets worse as you get older. The things that I feel, the things that I deal with, it's gotten worse as I've gotten older. I'm at a point now where I'm in graduate school. I'm in like that percentage where it's not a whole bunch of us in the program or just in general in graduate school. And I'm doing my thing. I got a 4.0. I told myself I'm going to go to graduate school. I'm going to make sure I get a 4.0 and keep it. But the trauma is coming back because I got a 4.0 and I feel like if I get a 3.9 or a 3.8, I'm failing. Why do I feel that way? I just realized that through this conversation that you have a problem mentally because you look like you look at a 3.8, which is a high B, a low A, as a failing grade. That goes back to that high achieving and wanting to be the best of the best, because you know that people look at even a little bit of success as failure. If you're Black, if you have Black skin, if you're male or female, doesn't matter. If you have Black skin, you have to always be above the rest. So I just wanted to say that because I know there's going to be a lot of people my age that are in graduate programs or undergraduate that are probably going to listen to this, and they just want somebody to understand where they're coming from. So I just want to tell everybody that is listening to this right now, there's nothing wrong with you. It's just the way the system is made. You're a product of the environment. Like, that's just what it is. But you don't have to stay there. You just find a way to cope. And honestly, if you got to be the best of the best, I'm okay with that, because I like being great. So I just wanted to say that. I love that you brought it up. And I love this conversation because it really did help me, crystallize that idea. So that's all I wanted to say. I appreciate this conversation.
Thank you. So before we end, this is how I'm going to end this episode. Although I'm going to call, some people say, what's your gem? What's your last piece of advice? I'm going to call this, what's your mic drop? I think that was a really good mic drop for you, Will. Do you have an additional mic drop before we end?
No, I just say Black Lives Matter.
Black Lives Matter. All right. Thank you. Dr. Smith, what's your mic drop?
Man, we got to fight it. We got to dismantle white supremacy, and we got to be intentional about it. Be real with it. I think having these real conversations with people who are uncomfortable, having these kinds of conversations is what matters. Because if we're just talking among ourselves, we ain't getting the job done. We got to take it to the people who need to hear it. And so how do we get these messages out to our allies, those who say they're not racist, right? I'm not racist, sure. But let me see you become anti-racist. Let's bring down these systems that we need to dismantle as it relates to white supremacy.
Amen. How do I follow that mic drop? Both of those mic drops. Here's what I'll add. And this is what I add usually when I talk about this. Because when people listen to this, and I would imagine when we're all finished with this, there's going to be some continuous reflection. People will need to sit with this, and they're going to start to process their own feelings. Here's what I'll add, and here's what I continuously remind myself of when I need to pep talk and remind myself of my greatness and remind my students of color and my colleagues of color of their greatness. And I'm pulling, because I'm a quotes person. I'm quoting Dr. Brené Brown. She's a famous author and researcher, scholar. Don't walk through the world looking for reasons why you don't belong, because if you do, you'll always find them, right? You've made that your goal, to look for reasons why you don't belong, right? You do belong. We're worthy. We're real. We're not magical unicorns. We're out here doing the damn thing. So continue to surround yourself with Black and brown greatness, so that when you don't see your own greatness, you see it in other people. Dr. Smith, future Dr. Nicholson, I keep saying that because we have the expectation that you're going to go on and become Dr. Nicholson. So we're going to keep calling you that. I've enjoyed vibing with you all today. I want to thank you for participating in this interview, for sharing so much of your story, because I know how vulnerable it is to share this. And thank you again for participating in this interview for This Week in Black History, Society, and Culture, a podcast program of the Black and African Diaspora Forum of Monmouth University. Thank you.
Thank you.